We are in the 11th chapter of Daniel, and we've gotten down to the 40th verse. The prophecy up until this time has been relating to the kingdoms of the north and the south, of course talking about Syria and Egypt. And then the prophecy projects further into the future, and it deals with the Roman Empire and the political and religious combination of it with Catholicism and the apostate church. And so in verses 31 through 39, it has to do with that circumstance. We discussed that last time. Now, beginning with verse 40. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. Now, beginning with verse 40 here, we have events. It now seems that we begin to talk about the king of the south and of the north. But in order to understand, the time about which he's speaking. Mr. Clark says, these kings are to be understood in reference to the times of which the prophet speaks. While the kingdoms of Egypt and Syria were subsisting, the king of the south and the north apply to them exclusively. That's back in our earlier verses. While Syria and Egypt existed, while they were the prime powers, that's who these phrases related to. But they did not exist at the time of which the prophet speaks. Therefore, other southern and northern powers must be sought. We're talking about a time now after Syria and Egypt were these powers, a time after the Roman Empire had become the supreme power, so there has to be another group of powers or powers that would fulfill this phrase of the kingdoms of the south and of the north. These we may find in the Saracens, who were of the Arabians, who came from the south, headed by the false prophet Mohammed, who pushed at him and made war on the Greek emperor Heraclius with amazing rapidity, deprived him of Egypt, Syria, and many of his finest provinces. So when he speaks here now, and at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. This is probably the forces of Mohammedan, who did come forth from the south, and who made war on the Roman Empire, who made war on the eastern portion of it, so that by the year about 1453, they completely captured the city of Constantinople. Now, we covered a lot of this, you remember, in our study of Revelation, how that the powers of the Mohammedan forces were a major checkpoint of the advance of Catholicism. Well, this is probably what this is speaking of here. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. Now, the king of the north is probably the Turks. As Mr. Clark says, the Turks were originally Scythians, seized on the remains of the Greek Empire, and in the process of time rendered themselves masters of the whole. They were represented as coming like whirlwinds with chariots and with horsemen, their armies being chiefly composed of cavalry. And then he says that they would come with many ships. With these, they got possession of many islands and maritime countries, and were so powerful in their fleets that they entirely defeated the Venetians, and at last their fleet became the utmost consequence to them in besieging and afterwards taking Constantinople in A.D. 1453, which they hold to the present day. Now, the present day, of course, was 1825 when he wrote this. So they entered into the countries and overflowed, rendering themselves masters of all Asia Minor and Greece. Now, Mr. Clark seemed to think that all this took place about that time whenever the Mohammedans started in about 1630 or so, 630 A.D., and then they were conquerors of and held this territory until the 20th century. And as we get to some of these dates later on here in the 12th chapter, these times, that might be one of the times that's mentioned in that 12th chapter. Verse 41, he shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hands, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. He says that Aleppo, Damascus, Gaza, and many other cities were forced to submit to them, and they hold them still. And then Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon, these and other Arabians, they have never been able to subdue. They still occupy the deserts and receive a yearly pension of 40,000 crowns of gold from the Ottoman empires to permit the caravans with the pilgrims from Mecca to have a free passage. So he shows how that this prophecy seems to be fulfilled right down to the last detail. Verse 42. Well, in 41 where he says, and he shall enter into the glorious land, would be to entirely subdue the country of Judea. That's the glorious land. Verse 42, he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He, that is the Ottoman emperors, have stretched forth a hand not only on European, but also upon Asiatic and African countries. Egypt has not escaped. It is a province of the Turkish government, as are the Fez, Morocco, Algiers, and many other African countries. And as the prophecy says, they got power over the silver and gold and the precious things of Egypt. So it was, for when Selim conquered Egypt in A.D. 1517, he took all its spoils and the immense sums drawn from it to the present day, and the wretchedness of the land in consequence are almost incredible. So in verse 43, the text says, but he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. Now, Mr. Clark says that the Libyans and Ethiopians, that they are the unconquered Arabs, all sought their friendship, and many of them are tributary to the present time. Now, in verse 44, but tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to take away many. Now it's thought at verse 44 that the prophecy now goes into the future. These are things that have not yet come to pass. And how much of a period of time it may cover would be difficult to say. But when we tie this in with the 12th chapter, it seems to go right on up to the end of time. Mr. Clark says about verse 44, the first part of it, this part of the prophecy is allowed to be yet unfulfilled, and what is portended, the course of prophetic events will show. Were we to understand it as applying to Antiochus, Antiochus is that king back there that we've already finished talking about, who lived in the B.C. time, then the news might be of the preparations which he heard that the provinces of the east and Artaxerxes, the king of Armenia on the north, were intending to rise up against him. But if the Turkish power be understood, as in the preceding verses, it may mean the Persians on the east and the Russians on the north, will it sometimes greatly embarrass the Ottoman government. Now, we don't know what it means. He goes on to give an explanation of what it could mean, but it's most difficult to say. But now remember, we're talking about that area of the country, which would include Germany and Italy and Turkey today. And This may have been fulfilled, say, in World War II. It may be yet to be fulfilled. We can't say for sure. But there are several events in history that would fit what he has said here. He said, but tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. This could be Russia. This could be those powers in the east, the Arabians. We could make all kinds of conjectures into what it could be. And I think it's safer, though, not to make a statement that it is this or that it is that, because we simply just cannot say for sure what it is. Therefore, he shall go forth with great fear to destroy and utterly to take away many. This might even be World War II or maybe a war yet to come. And he shall plant the tabernacles of his palaces between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end and none shall help him. Now this in verse 45 seemed to indicate that he's going to conquer the children of Israel. He's going to subdue them. He's going to plant the tabernacles of his palaces between the seas in the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end and none shall help him. And I think it's rather futile for us to try to project what this may be or even what it what may have already happened to fulfill this. Mr. Clark says about planting the tabernacles, he shall make a last stand in Judea, and there shall his power be smitten. And he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. All his confederate and tributary kingdoms, states, and provinces shall desert him and leave that government to come to a shameful end. Now, Mr. Clark goes on further to say that he has, in the interpretation of this chapter, followed generally a man that he calls Bishop Newton in his most excellent dissertations on the prophecies, consulting other eminent authors occasionally. From the beginning of the chapter to the end of verse 30, all is very clear and plain relative to the Grecian, Syrian, and Egyptian histories. From the 31st verse to the end, the mode of interpretation is not so satisfactory in its application to the times since Christ. Yet possibly these alone may be intended, though the whole might be with considerable ease applied to the remaining part of the Syrian and Egyptian history. It's a wonderful piece of prophecy and of great utility to the cause of divine revelation. Now we're ready to go into the 12th chapter, and I hope we will be able to finish the 12th chapter tonight. The 12th chapter just has 13 verses, and it has some statements in here that are impossible to make a clear-cut application to. But it begins in the first verse, and at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people. That's commonly thought that Michael was the angel that was the protector of God's people. So he says, shall Michael stand up, the great prince which standeth for the children of thy people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one of them shall be found written in the book. Now here's where we get into some difficult, deep prophecy. He says, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. Now you might try to relate this to different kinds of wars, to different kinds of events that have happened. And it seemed that this statement has probably had lesser fulfillments and has fulfillment to occur. If it's talking strictly about the... for example, we could think very easily some of the events of World War II, whenever the Jews were atrociously persecuted, put into concentration camps, driven from their homes, and all manner of horrible things happened to them. And that's a possibility that it could be talking about that. And then when he says, And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one of them shall be found written, every one that shall be found written in the book. This could be referring to a coming back of the Jewish people to God. It could be the time in which the Israelites come back and they are grafted again into the olive tree. They have faith as they should have, and the natural branches are again restored to their proper position. The fullness of the Gentiles has come in, and as Romans 11 says, all Israel shall be saved. Could be referring to that. And even the next verse, and many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, even to everlasting life, and some to shame, and some to everlasting contempt. This could be referring to them. Romans says, you know, if the casting off of them was a blessing, what should the coming back of them be but life from the dead? So they could be referring to that very easily, we see, as a fulfillment of this. But I have to think that the ultimate fulfillment of this passage, these first two verses, I have to think that this has to be relating also to the end of the world. And as we think of the end of the world, when he says, there shall never be a time of trouble such as never was, there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time, and at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one of them that shall be found written in the book, this certainly could apply to the end of time. And the next phrase in which he says, and many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, even to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt, that could be referring to the resurrection of the dead, the resurrection. Because we do know that there is coming a time in which there is going to be a resurrection. Them that sleep in the dust are going to be brought forth. Some are going to be for everlasting life, and some are going to be to shame and everlasting contempt. That's going to be, of course, just prior to the great judgment. And there will be no reprieve from that judgment. If you receive life at that judgment, it'll be everlasting life. And if you receive shame and contempt at that judgment, it'll be everlasting contempt. I would like to notice this phrase here in which he says, there shall be found written in the book. This is a phrase that's used quite often in the Bible. I say quite often. It's half a dozen or so times in the Bible in which he makes it this a statement of this nature. I'd like to turn and read two or three of them. In Exodus 32, beginning with verse 32, he makes a statement very similar to this. Now this is Moses who is praying for the people after they have been guilty of idolatry. And Moses, verse 31, returned unto the Lord and said, O, this people have sinned a great sin and have made them gods of gold. Yet now if thou wilt forgive their sin, and if not, blot me, I pray thee, out of thy book which thou hast written. Moses prayed that he be blotted out of the book if God wouldn't forgive the people of their sin. And the Lord said unto Moses, Whosoever has sinned against me, him will I blot out of my book. So it's the Lord's prerogative as to who is blotted out of the book and who is not blotted out of the book. He said it's the one that sins against me. He's the one that's going to be blotted out of my book. So one man cannot stand and say, I'll take the punishment for somebody else. I'll bear his responsibility, his obligation. I'll be at fault and let him be free, because the Lord told Moses that the way that this thing is conducted is that I will blot the one out who sins against me. And so we see there that this allusion is made to God having a book and to certain ones having their names written in the book and to certain deeds causing them to have their name blotted out of the book. And that then fits with, at that time, thy people shall be delivered, everyone that shall be found written in the book. We have this also in the Psalms and in Isaiah and then also in the New Testament several times. In Luke 10 and 20, whenever his disciples had come back after he'd sent them out to preach, and they said that the devils are subject to us, and he says, "Rejoice not because the devils are subject to you, but rejoice because your names are written in the book of life." So there he makes a strong allusion to the fact that the name written in the book of life. And over in Philippians, the fourth chapter, and the third verse, Paul says, "And I entreat thee also, true yoke fellow, help those women which labored with me in the gospel, with Clement also, and with other my fellow laborers whose names are in the book of life." Very definite now, allusions made to this fact that God has a book, the names are written in it, it's known as the book of life. Then we also read about these being judged out of the things written in the book in Revelation, and the woe that's upon those who are not found written in the book. Well, so this seems to be then to me a prophecy that very definitely could apply to the end of time. And then he says, "Many that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt." We know this fits the resurrection of the dead. In Matthew 25, verse 46, Jesus makes this statement, "And these shall go away into everlasting punishment, but the righteous into life eternal." So that's the way it's going to be at the judgment after the resurrection, and this is exactly the way he describes it here. Verse 3, "And they that be wise shall shine as the brightness of the firmament, and they that turn many to righteousness as the stars forever and ever." Now they that be wise, and they that turn many to righteousness, that has to be the saved. Those are the people of God. We'd like to point out that always, in every case, the allusion to God's people is one of the wise, one of those that are in the know, those that have knowledge, those that are of the day, those that are sober, those that are watchful, those that are vigilant. The Christian religion is a religion of intelligence, not of blind emotion, not of just a certain feeling, not of a bunch of vain traditions, but it's a religion of intelligence. Time and time again, we're told that we are to know, we're to be wise. So here it is in this time in which there'll be a time of trouble that never any nation had up to this time. Those that are wise, which would have to be the followers of God who do know what God's will is and who are in accordance with God's laws, and also they that turn many to righteousness. They're going to be those that spread the gospel. They're going to be those who are trying to recruit others to the walk of God, in our particular case, the Christian walk. They then, he says, shall shine as the brightness of the firmament and as the stars forever and ever. So he's depicting what kind of a condition they're going to be in. If they're wise, if they're turning many to righteousness, they'll be as the brightness of the firmament and as of the stars forever and ever. So we don't want to be among those that are unwise, among those that are unlearned or ignorant, those that are blindly following some kind of a feeling. The implication is here they're going to not be shining. They're not going to be bright. They're going to be in a very bad condition. Then in verse 4 he says, "But thou, O Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book, even to the time of the end. Many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." Let me read what Mr. Clark says about this verse. "When a prophet received a prediction concerning what was at a considerable distance of time, he shut the book. did not communicate his revelation for some time after. This Daniel was commanded to do in chapter 3 and 26. Among the ancients, I'm going to read that paragraph. So it seems that Daniel here is told, after having a view of the end, of the resurrection of the dead, and of the fact that the wise and those that turn men into righteous are going to shine after that time. They'll be among those that are resurrected to everlasting life, and the wicked will be among those resurrected to shame and everlasting contempt. Then he tells Daniel, shut up the words of this book. The prophecy has gone just so far. It's going to be a distant time before this is fulfilled, and so it's not time to communicate it. That's what he seems to be saying. But he says, even to the time of the end, many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased. The time of the end could be taken several ways. The New Testament age could be the time of the end. Beginning back, whenever the Holy Spirit came back and John the Baptist began his ministry even. That could be the beginning of the time of the end. Or the time of the end might be a dispensation within this Christian age. The time that the, for example, that the apostate church was subdued and Satan was bound. Or the time in which Satan was loosed for a little season. So there's many ways that you could take it. And it has been, the word has been released, but we don't understand all of it, but we'll understand a big part of it. Then where he says, many shall run to and fro and knowledge shall be increased, this is interpreted several ways. Some of the scholars say that it means that because this prophecy is so difficult and so hard to uncover and reveal, that it'll be like many running to and fro, trying to get to the truth of it, trying to get to the meaning of it. And as they uncover one little scrap of evidence and another little scrap of evidence in their diligent studying, which is described here as running to and fro, that knowledge shall be increased. Others say what this means is, as we come to the end, Christians are going to be so busy trying to disseminate, well, that'll be counted as the to and fro and the disseminating of this knowledge, and the knowledge then being increased. That it could even apply to the works of the apostles and their companions as they spread the gospel. A small number beginning with so few and then spreading the gospel to the world. And others take a more literal, not a more literal, but a more temporal interpretation of it. In Haley's Bible Handbook, he says that many shall run to and fro and knowledge shall be increased is to be characteristic of the time of the end. This too applies to our own generation as it has to no other. Trains, automobiles, ships, airplanes, books, newspapers, and radios as a means of travel and dissemination of knowledge on a scale never before dreamed of. And now on top of all this has come the nuclear bomb, which has struck terror to the hearts of men to such a degree that it makes us wonder if we may be living in the period of which Jesus spoke of as a setting for his return. On the earth, distress of nations, in perplexity for the roaring of the sea, men fainting for fear and expectation of the things that are coming on the world. Luke 21, 25, 26. So there's various interpretations of this fourth verse. And a lot of them are just reading a whole lot into this. I prefer to think, and this is, of course, just my opinion, but I prefer to think that this has to do with Daniel shutting up the word and sealing the book, and then men trying to uncover the meaning of the book, and as they do, then knowledge is increased. So it could relate to that, but it's interesting to note how that's worded. Now, beginning in the fifth verse, the prophecy gets deeper and even more difficult to really interpret. Then I, Daniel, looked, and behold, there stood other two the one on this side of the bank of the river and the other on that side of the bank of the river. Now this is thought to be two angels that Daniel saw, and the river was probably or possibly the Tigris River. And one said to the man clothed in linen. Now the man clothed in linen is probably Gabriel, because that's the description of Gabriel that was given back in chapter 10, verse 5. So one said to the man clothed in linen, which was upon the waters of the river, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? Now, the question, of course, should tell us a lot about the answer. But this is a question that, here again, is so difficult to interpret. A very difficult question to interpret. The question, how long shall it be to the end of these wonders? Does this mean how long from the time this prophecy is given to